Christian long enough, you will experience the silence of God. I don't know if you've been in that situation where you felt that God has been very distant, very silent. A friend of mine, a faithful Christian girl, in this kind of situation, she'd made sacrificial decisions. She'd decided to choose not to do things that she might have done, chosen not to do things that she figured God didn't want her to do. But she had hopes and dreams. And though she's prayed constantly about those prayers haven't been answered. Not to this point, and all she feels is a tremendous silence of God. All like the friends I've got who are working on their marriage, had a few cracks in it, wasn't going as well as they wanted it to be, but they were doing okay. She went to counselling, and under counselling, the wife suddenly recalled an event that took place in her childhood, an event of tremendous trauma. She'd never remembered it before. It suddenly came to light. Her husband wasn't to blame. It was years before they'd ever met. But suddenly, there was just an entire emotional block. She couldn't communicate with him. He couldn't communicate with her. God wasn't putting it right. There was nothing but silence. And in the midst of the silence, his faith began to die. The silence of God, you will experience it. The psalmist knew the silence of God. Let me read for you. Awake, O Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself. Don't reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression? Rise up and help us. Redeem us because of your unfailing love. Job experienced the silence of God. I cry to you for help. You don't answer me. I stand and you only look at me. King David experienced the silence of God. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you don't answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Here's the experience of believers for, 3,500 years that you will experience the silence of God at times in your life when there's tremendous suffering. The non-Christian expects the silence of God. They cry alone in their bed at night in an empty universe. They drag themselves through the day and they wait until the evening comes because there's nobody to help. But the Christian knows a God who does answer prayer. So when his silence comes, if you've been in this situation, you know how much worse that is. It's a tremendous challenge to faith to keep going. C.S. Lewis made the comment, we're not necessarily doubting that God will do the best for us. We're just wondering how painful the best will turn out to be. Because though we can say God's at work to do you good, in the midst of the suffering and the silence, it's tremendously painful. Now this episode in Matthew 15 concerns the silence of God. But its great value to us is that it helps us understand at least three reasons behind that silence. Come to verse 21 there and pick it up right there at the outset. Jesus is far from home in Gentile territory. He's in the region of Tyre and Sidon. That's that region on the coast of the Mediterranean, which seems all lovely up toward the north of where Israel actually is. And a local Canaanite woman comes to him crying out, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly. In verse 23, notice Jesus' response. He doesn't answer a word. Unusual, actually, when you read this passage. Although she'd been very persistent. Now, what tells you she's been very persistent? Well, the fact that in the very same verse, his disciples come to him and say, send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. Obviously, it's more than one instance of her calling out to him. But it's not just silence that Jesus gives her. Verse 24, he also gives her a reason. But notice, and if you've got the Bible there in front of you, don't go grab one off the table there. Notice it's not a very encouraging reason. Not at face value. She's a Gentile. And he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Well, that's kind of a brick wall, right? She's a Gentile. I was sent to these people. It's no go for you. Jesus had a mission to fulfill, by the way. He had three short years to take the word of the gospel to all the region of Israel with 12 disciples who hadn't got it and weren't getting it real quick, as a matter of interest. And his disciples, when they finally did get sorted, their role was to take the gospel to the rest of the nations. But it's a funny reason he gives here. And I wonder if you've ever noticed that. Because it didn't stop him back in chapter 8. Remember what happens back in chapter 8? The centurion comes to him and asks Jesus to heal his paralyzed servant. And do the maths on that. Both of those guys were Gentiles. The centurion and his servant, both Gentiles. It didn't stop Jesus in John chapter 4. John chapter 4, he meets the woman from Samaria. He's passing through that area. The Samaritans are mortal enemies of the Jews. She was a Gentile. And it didn't stop him then. And it didn't stop him a few days later, after this episode itself. Because down there in the very next episode, and verse 32, he tells his disciples, I've got compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days. They've got nothing to eat. I don't want to send them away hungry, or they'll collapse on the way. And just like in chapter 14 that we looked at a week or so ago, where he fed 5,000 Jewish men, plus women and children, here he feeds 4,000 of them. And you'd guess from the area that he's in, they're all Gentiles. He's silent. That's the first thing when the woman comes to him. And then he makes up an excuse. And it seems like he makes up an excuse because it's not super encouraging. And when that doesn't work, she comes and kneels before him and says, Lord, help me. And it's a simple, sincere prayer. And verse 26, notice, it doesn't work. It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Now, I don't know, are you feeling uneasy here? There's a couple of things here that make you wonder about Jesus. Verse 26, did he just call her a dog? Did he just do that? Call her a dog? Did the Son of God hit her with a racial slur designed to say, Jews are better than Gentiles? Like, imagine the headlines today. Imagine what's all over those Facebook pages, all over your Instagram accounts, pictures of Jesus. Like, this guy's a racist. It would be just on for young and old. And giving away the children's bread, isn't that exactly what he's going to do, verse 29 and following? He's got 4,000 of those Gentile people there, and he's going to give away so much bread that in verse 37, there's 7 basketfuls left over. That's odd, isn't it? First, she's straight out ignored. Then the disciples say, beat it, get her out of here. Then Jesus makes what looks like a really lame excuse. Then he calls her a dog. It's not the Jesus you know and love. And it's not very seeker sensitive, is it? So what is going on in this scene? And what does it tell you about the silence of God? Which, as you notice in verse 28, is ultimately broken with great fanfare. Wonderful kind of celebration. Now the key is in the story Matthew's telling. It's the story he's telling about him and his disciples. It's why Jesus came himself as the archetypal, the classic disciple, the one who comes from the Father as the perfect Son, who needs to learn obedience, learn what it's like actually to follow the Father in a broken world. It's why his gospel ends, remember that famous commission where he sends the disciples to the nations. Jesus wants his disciples to be people who are absolutely uniquely different to the world around them and absolutely and uniquely contrasted with one people group that you keep seeing in this gospel. Who do you think that is? It's the Pharisees. He doesn't want them to pray like them. He doesn't want them to give like them. He doesn't want them to fast like them or worship like them. Chapter 16 and verse 5, he doesn't want them to listen, his disciples, to the teaching of the Pharisees. Chapter 15 and verse 3, he doesn't want them to get so tied up with man-made traditions that break the commands of God like the Pharisees did. But above all, he says to them, don't be hard-hearted like the Pharisees are, because remember that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. Because he's not come to call those who think they're healthy. He's come to call sinners and outcasts to repentance. Who's the sinner and the outcast in this story? Well, it's the woman, like with a big capital O. She's a massive outcast. To the hard-hearted Pharisees, the Gentiles of that day were the biggest outcasts, separated from the Jews completely by things like food laws, ceremonies, traditions, washings. You find them in the earlier part of this chapter. The kinds of things the Pharisees prized and the kinds of things that in verse 20 Jesus had said are actually beside the point. Not interested in those things. The Gentiles were despised in Israel, but ironically in this gospel, while the Jews, including the disciples, are said to be people of little faith, who do you think are the only people in this gospel who are people of big faith? The Gentiles. In fact, two Gentiles, the centurion for one, who do you think the other one is? This woman. She's the one who has incredible faith. Contrast her now with the disciples. Right? Matthew deliberately calls her a Canaanite woman, meaning what? Know your Old Testament, what does Canaanite woman mean? In Canaan, they all settled in Canaan, yeah, because the Canaanites, who were the inhabitants of the land, were, pagan, heathen, Israel's most hated enemies, worshippers of Baal, Molech, Ashtoreth, you name it, practicing incest, black magic, ritual prostitution, witchcraft, child sacrifice, and on and on and on. And this is the woman from that kind of background who comes to Jesus and relentlessly prays, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now, where did she learn that? Jesus, the Son of David. I mean, it's not like there was a Sydney Morning Herald or something like that she could read and pick this up, like on Facebook or anything like that, and learn it from there. Where did she learn it? I don't know. But notice this. She is not put off by the silence. She is not put off by the disciples' rejection. She's not put off by Jesus' put off or the apparent racial insult. Instead, she refuses to give up. Verse 26, it's not right to take the children's bread, toss it to the dogs. And she comes and kneels at his feet and says, yes, it is, Lord. For even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And in that statement, she captured the essence of the gospel in a way that the disciples haven't got at all. Israel, like many today, thought they were worthy, actually, to sit at God's table, to eat that big feast at the end that we're going to celebrate in a moment, in a little way, Lord's Supper. They figured they were kind of the ones who were worthy to do that, to eat from God's table, not really realizing actually they were outcasts, like all of us, who deserve nothing. Actually, that Jesus had to come and die like a dog so we could even come to the table and eat the crumbs in the first place. But the disciples didn't get it. Guess who got it? The woman got it in a way they weren't even anywhere near grasping. That's uncanny faith, isn't it? That is extraordinary. And I think Jesus wants the disciples to see it. At the height of the Reformation, Thomas Cranmer, I don't know if you heard that name, Thomas Cranmer, some of you have, he was the English reformer. All under the Reformation, all those churches that had been effectively Roman Catholic were coming out of Roman Catholicism to grasp something of what the gospel was about. And 1548, Thomas Cranmer wrote a prayer that we typically celebrate when we celebrate communion together, drawn from this text. And some of you, if you've been around in those churches where we pray those kind of prayers, you'll remember it. Let me recite it for you. We don't presume to come to your table, merciful Lord, trusting in our own goodness. Know this? but in your all-embracing love and mercy. We're not worthy even to gather up the crumbs under your table, but it's your nature always to have mercy. It was the beginning of Cranmer's prayer. He picked it up out of here. He picked it up from that woman, actually. She got it. The disciples weren't even in the ballpark. Consider their faith for a moment. Take your mind back to last week. Remember? Peter kind of walking on the water, gets out of his depth, he's sinking. And remember, he's the most faithful disciple. And he's sinking because his faith failed. And he cries out the self-same prayer. She prays here, "Save me, Lord." And Jesus takes mercy on him and reaches out his hand and pulls Peter back into the boat. Now, here's the funny thing. It's just a classic kind of Christian blind spot thing. I'm not mocking you because, like, we all do this, right? But Peter, like, one episode later, who knows how much later it was, can't find it in himself to extend the same compassion to her. He hadn't got it at all. Instead, he says, "Send her away. She's bugging us." So, come back to the question. What lies behind the silence of God, which if you've not faced, you will? I promise you, at some point you will. Three things. And number one is a question of timing. It's what lies behind Jesus' silence. Because notice, come the end of this episode, verse 28 there, he will give her what she asked for. He hasn't given it to her yet. And there's a reason for that. He's only going to give it to her after he's achieved numbers 2 and 3. Number two, what's it? Number two is it's a test for a woman who's very faithful. Jesus wants to draw something out of her. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. Number three is this. It's a lesson for heartless disciples. Because at one and the same time, by Jesus' very calculated silence, he'll draw out so the disciples can see it, the faith of this woman, and show it to be just extraordinary in a way that nobody else in Israel has demonstrated, brighter than any that they've come across yet. Verse 28 there at the end, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted," and her daughter was healed at that moment. Do you think he didn't know that at the outset? Of course he did. Of course he did. Here's the third thing, though. He shows his disciples, who in less than a year will be charged with bringing the gospel to all the nations, that they've got a real long way to go. Because though they've been with him such a long time, they lack their master's compassion. They don't have even a sniff of it. And they lack the insight to see themselves and the world as they really are. It's tragic. To see people as, and to see themselves actually as lost, helpless dogs. Don't deserve the scraps that fall from the table. Struggling to shake off the self-righteousness of the Pharisee. Whom, actually, if you look at that previous episode, obviously the disciples held in high esteem. Have a look at chapter 15, verse 12 in your own time in a moment. Because the disciples are aghast that Jesus should offend the Pharisees. I think Jesus did it deliberately because he wants the disciples to make a choice. Don't be like them. Now, there's an issue in all this. It's worthwhile pondering personally before we come to the conclusions about the silence of God. But self-righteousness, do you find it a problem? I don't know any Christian that doesn't find it a problem. I find it a problem. My inner Pharisee lurks in my heart constantly. It always makes concessions for me. It rarely makes concessions for others. I'm always compassionate and understanding of my own sins. I'm rarely compassionate and understanding of other people's sins. I think, get your act together. What is your problem? And therefore, that lack of compassion always affects our witness. Because in our hearts, we find it easy to assume that our friends are actually far away. So far away from the gospel they could never be saved. When actually, it wasn't such a long time ago when we were far away, we were dead in our sins, but we give up too easily on non-Christian friends and family. And I say that to you with Easter coming. Think, pray, Take a chance. Who will you invite? You know, over the last couple of years here, every year we see people converted at Easter. They wander in here unsuspecting. They hear the gospel. God can change them. They didn't come here thinking that would happen. It happens every year. And it could happen this year. Think who you'll invite. Brings you back then finally to the silence of God. What do you learn from Jesus about God's reasons for keeping silent? What do you learn about that? Now let me tell you, when the young Christian feels the silence of God, he or she, and you'll be tempted to do it, will leap to the conclusion that God isn't real, or that he has abandoned you, or that he's unkind, or that he's angry. And we know in our heads that it can't be true, even if we feel that it is. And it is the case that it's like the veteran soldier who's got lots of campaigns under their belt, that in time our thinking ought to change so we don't have our thoughts run down that same track again and again as the years go by, failing to ever move forward. But it's possible for Christians to do that. Very possible. For the very young Christian, the not thought through Christian, to again and again simply think God is being angry, he's being unkind, and then you run away. Martin Luther, now remember Martin Luther, kind of the great reformer, he went through a period of time in his life when he was tempted to think that God had abandoned him. And he told his wife, Katie, that God was being so silent with him that he may as well be dead. Not Luther, but God. and Luther, when he went out, his very cunning wife decided to teach him a lesson. I'm not saying wives, I'm not saying be cunning, and I'm not saying decide to teach your husbands a lesson. I'm just saying this is what this particular woman did, right? She pulled all the curtains closed, so the house was absolutely dark. She dressed in black. So when he got home, and saw the signs of death on the windows, in the clothing, the lights out, all that sort of thing. He called her and said, Katie, who's died? She said, God, remember? And he got the point. You know, he got the point. He'd been foolish. She was wise enough to help him see that even the great reformer can think like a child. And we don't want to be people who continue to think like children. Whatever the reason for God's silence, it's not that he's died, it's not that he's forgotten you, it's not that he's angry with you. Sometimes God's silence is meant to strengthen us by drawing out of us something that may be there. And that's the case with the woman. Her faith absolutely was there. The disciples, dopey as they were, hadn't seen it at this point. But Jesus was determined that they would see it. Or something that should be there but isn't there. So God presents an opportunity to grow it, that we might be people who are more than we currently are. We move forward in Christian life. Let me just say, off the record for a moment, one of the great struggles I find in pastoring is that you deal with people who again and again come to an obstacle and they look for the... They look for the solution that simply changes their circumstances. Do you know what I mean? I need to go somewhere else. I've had a breakdown in a relationship with that person. Can't get it right. I'm going to go to another church or whatever it might be. I haven't got enough friends and so I'll go to another church. I've had a falling out with someone in a situation. I don't like the way they do this. I'm going to go to another church. And so in every instance, it's I will simply change my circumstances rather than work through the situation so you grow in it. And I find, to get Christians to do that, tremendous problem. Remember what you signed up for when you became a Christian? You said, Lord Jesus, save me and change my life. But when it comes to the fork in the road, the hardship, we say, no, don't change me. I just want to go somewhere else and do my own thing. Remember it when it comes to that point. Remember it. Phil Keaggy is an old Christian musician. And I'm going to ask how many people here know who Phil Keaggy is? Okay. Yeah. How many people know? But the name's not kind of... Who's that most brilliant guitarist of all time? No, Eric Clapton. No, not Jimi Hendrix. It's Jimi Hendrix. Yeah, yeah. When Jimi Hendrix was at the height of his fame, he was saying, some reporter asked him, how does it feel to be the greatest guitarist in the world? And his answer was, you obviously haven't heard of Phil Keaggy. Phil Keaggy's a Christian musician, right? So he's old now. And he put it like this in a song. So I'm going to recite you a couple of lines from disappointment, his appointment. Change one letter, then I see that the thwarting of my purpose is God's better choice for me. His appointment must be blessing, though it may come in disguise, for the end from the beginning open to his wisdom lies. That's just a change of a word, disappointment, his appointment. God knows what he's doing. If you're struggling at the moment, that is to say in your own Christian life, and we don't know about it, you're struggling, you may find tonight hard to bear. And I spoke to a girl this morning who said, yeah, it was confronting, but it was good for her. You might find it hard to bear, and I know that. I know it. And a bunch of us here have been there. We know it's hard to bear. But I would pray that a time will come when you can hear this and you can rejoice in it and you can get back on the horse and remember God isn't silent to hurt you. Sometimes, though, like with the disciples, God's silence to us is a lesson not for you. Now, often it may be a lesson for you. Sometimes it's a lesson for other people, actually. Did Jesus call her a dog? Which in that day was the common term for the Gentile. Apparently the word he uses there, and this is the way some commentators talk about it, is like a playful word. It's like the household pet kind of word. He doesn't call the mangy, you know, moth-eaten dog that was the usual word that was used around this time. But I think the far bigger thing in this is that Jesus, in his wisdom, uses the woman's obvious faith to show the disciples how hard-hearted they were, how callous they were, that they should ever use that term for her, that they should think about it like that, was just so unfitting for someone who clearly was a member of the kingdom. When you're feeling the silence of God, don't assume that the lesson is for you. Don't assume it's for you. John Newton, remember Merrily? Back, and we support Merrily, and we're going to give you an update at the Grace Vision afternoon about how support's going for Merrily, because we as a congregation are supporting her in the Middle East. But this is so classic Merrily. Before she went to the Middle East, she bought me a book. You know, you'd figure we'd buy her a book for going away. No, she bought me a book. She bought me a book about John Newton. John Newton's the guy who wrote that hymn, Amazing Grace, and some of you know that, and we talked about it at Summerfest. He was a great pastor, and over the years he'd noticed that there are people in Christian life who suffer more than their fair share. And Newton called them, and I think I've told you guys this at Summerfest if you were there, he called them burning bushes. Now, there's that term obviously taken from Exodus chapter 3, where Moses comes and sees that burning bush, and his attention is drawn to it. Because what God is seeking to do is to capture the attention. And sometimes suffering people, those who suffer an inordinate amount in Christian life, their suffering is designed to draw the attention of those who look on. So they ask exactly the same question Moses asked. And the question is this: why doesn't the bush burn up? Why doesn't that person who's experienced so much hardship, why don't they give up Christian life? What keeps them going? What is it about them that I can learn from them that actually enables them to persevere in the midst of great trials? And in the end, it achieves the greatest of goals. It draws the person who's watching back to the Saviour. Brings the person who's watching, the person who's lost back home. Keaggy's song goes on to say this: disappointment, his appointment. No good thing will he withhold. Remember that. From denials often we gather treasures from his love untold. Well he knows each broken purpose leads to fuller, deeper trust. And the end of all his dealings proves our God is wise and just. When you get to the fork in the road, you will have a decision. Do I trust God in this, or do I drop my bundle and give up and fear that he's angry with me or that he's got nothing for me? It may not be until heaven that you work out what's behind God's purposes for you, what's behind the suffering you've experienced. It may not even be in heaven that you work that out. And don't think that's surprising. Life is complex. In the web of cause and effect that we experience in life, that you could think to second guess what God's intentions are for someone beyond you is very unlikely. You may look back on it in years to come and think, I see it now. I see what it may have been. But no matter where you are today, you can know that God will waste nothing of what he does for you and nothing of the suffering that you experience. So trust him. Hang in. Don't drop your bundle. The times of silence will come. Remember it when you get to it. Let me pray, and if you want to ask some questions, we'll do that. Then we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper together.